Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. What have you done so far today? Chances are you solved some problems. It's what we do. Whether you're trying to cobble together an outfit when you've forgotten to do laundry, or you're pushing a company through a financial crisis, or you're a baby determined to pick up a Cheerio. There's a quote I like: "No problem can withstand the assault of sustained thinking." It's attributed to French philosopher Voltaire, and that's a good attitude to have, right? But some problems are so big and so complicated, especially in healthcare, we start to feel like Sisyphus, condemned to roll a boulder up a hill for eternity. It's people versus problems. On today's show, we'll meet people who are finding new paths, no matter how hard it is. They are tackling high drug prices, trying to slow the spread of HIV, or working to eliminate smoking. Let's start with a story about a problem that's new in this country. Here in the mainland part of the US, we're starting to see the first babies with birth defects caused by the Zika virus. And the American health system is at the very beginning of learning how to care for them. Our partners at Kaiser Health News bring us this story of a 20-year-old mom in the Seattle, Washington area. Here's reporter Heidi DeMarco.
3-month-old Ariana Sanchez Rios sits in her baby bouncer, a yellow bow in her hair and white patent leather shoes on her tiny feet.
Ariana! Ariana!
Her mother, Maria Rios, calls out to her from the kitchen as she fixes a baby bottle.
She smiles like when you talk to her, and she likes to be called beautiful. Hermosa! Hermosa! Right, mama?
Ariana smiles, there's milk dribbling down her chubby cheeks. Her head's a little smaller than most newborns. That's because she was born with microcephaly, though you may not notice it at first. Maria, a U.S. citizen, was infected with the mosquito-borne Zika virus while she was living with her husband in Colima, Mexico last year. The infection can cause microcephaly and a range of other severe birth defects, including brain damage, vision, and hearing problems.
When I was in Colima, I would see in the news that they would, like, report about Zika. They would talk about how it was, like, a devil's creation, and I was thinking, like, oh my God, poor babies, you know, like, what if that happened to me?
Maria says her doctors in Mexico told her she shouldn't be worried about the virus, but everyone else was talking about it. It was all over the news.
I really didn't trust them. They didn't even test me for Zika. It was just like, oh, it's okay, whatever, you know?
6 months into her pregnancy, an ultrasound showed that the baby's head hadn't developed as fast as it should. Rios decided it was time to fly back to the U.S., even if it meant leaving her husband behind. Maria had seen the terrifying photos of infants in Brazil and Puerto Rico. The baby's skulls were misshapen, even collapsed, ravaged by the Zika virus that has exploded across Latin America.
I was like, no, I need to go to the U.S. to be safer. And then I guess when I came, it was too late.
When Ariana was born in January, the first thing Maria checked out was the baby's head.
I was like, oh God, please don't let her have like a really flat head.
Ariana was born 5 pounds 10 ounces with a head almost 10 centimeters smaller than average, but Maria says all her fears disappeared when she cradled Ariana in her arms for the first time.
I was thinking that she was beautiful. I was telling her, you know, how much I loved her and cared for her, and I hoped everything was going to be good with her and she was healthy.
An early brain scan also showed extensive calcium deposits, more signs of potential brain damage caused by Zika. Still, Maria is hopeful.
I see Ariana, like, in the future being, like, a normal kid. Running, talking, going to school.
But the 3-month-old start in life is far from normal. A public health nurse and a physical therapist come every week to see Ariana. She has doctor's appointments lined up 6 months in advance.
Yeah, my sister supports me, her husband, my brother, but it's not the same as, like, your husband.
When the couple met, her husband Julio Sanchez was working in the U.S. as a landscaper on a temporary visa. Today, he works on his family's papaya farm in Colima. Meanwhile, Maria and Ariana live with her sister and brother-in-law in a 2-bedroom apartment in a small town south of Seattle.
Smile! Smile! Mamas!
Maria texts Julia constantly. She sits Ariana on her lap, and the latest is a photo of Ariana wearing a blue polka dot dress, and she had a beaded bracelet with the Blessed Virgin on her wrist.
He tells me, you know, like, everything's gonna be okay. We have his moral support, yeah, mama? I know it's hard, but, I mean, if I don't help her, who will help her, you know?
It's a 90-minute drive to Seattle Children's Hospital for another one of Ariana's checkups. When she arrives, a nurse technician measures Ariana's skull.
All right, and you can lay her down with her head touching the top here.
At 3 months, her head is still smaller than average.
There you go, good job. Bravo!
Through 9 hours of medical tests, Ariana is poked and prodded. Michelle Cabrera, a pediatric ophthalmologist at Seattle Children's, makes cooing noises as she shines a bright light into Ariana's dark eyes. An assistant has to pry the baby's eyes open as Ariana squirms and screams. The doctors find scarring on the baby's retinas, a defect that can be caused by Zika infections.
She does seem to have some tracking behaviors, and on our vision test, she was able to see stripes pretty normally for her age. But knowing that she has this scarring, we do know her vision will not be normal, and it's just a matter of how poorly developed it will be later.
Ariana is the first baby affected by Zika that Michelle Cabrera has cared for, and the specialists are still figuring out what treatment Ariana will need.
It's important for understanding how we could potentially help these children see better going forward and why the disease is happening there.
Another specialist, neurologist Hannah Tully, is an expert in microcephaly. She's seen many children with the condition, but Zika is different.
There are many things that we don't know about Zika. We don't know what the future holds in terms of the epidemic and how that will spread. Is it going to be a major problem and continue to move its way through the states, or is it going to remain a fairly localized, you know, with periodic epidemics? We don't know that. There's also very little known about the range of Zika. So it would be nice to know, you know, the whole iceberg and not just the tip of it.
Babies like Ariana are at the forefront of the outbreak in the mainland U.S. Cost is one big worry. Maria and Ariana are covered by Medicaid. Even the experts are guessing. Healthcare costs for a Zika-affected baby could range from $4 to $10 million over a child's lifetime.
You're such a big girl, mamas. You're such a big girl.
Back at the hospital, Maria is cheerful as she bounces Ariana on her knee. As she hands the baby over to her sister, the reality of her situation sets in. Maria steps outside for a quiet moment. She sits down at a table, places her head in her hands, and starts to cry.
I mean, I try to stay strong for her, but it's hard. Because I know that she's not going to be completely normal.
Gathering herself, she looks over at her daughter through the window.
She's always going to have challenges in her life, but I can't do anything about it. It's God's decision.
Heidi DeMarco reported this story together with her colleague Jonelle Alicia from Kaiser Health News, and Jonelle is here now to talk some more. Jonelle, how is Maria doing?
You know, we saw Maria and Ariana just last week, and they are doing as well as can be expected. She's a pretty cute baby.
Are healthcare providers keeping track of babies like Ariana around the country?
Well, in the U.S., the CDC has set up what's called the Zika Pregnancy Registry, where states report their cases in pregnant women and their babies. The number has been steadily rising, and now nearly 1,900 pregnant women have been reported with possible Zika infections since last year. When we first met Maria in early May, there were 58 babies who'd been born with Zika-related birth defects. At last count, the number was 72.
And it sounded like Maria was getting very good care at Seattle Children's, but how about elsewhere in the country? Are doctors ready to treat this?
Yeah, that's a real issue as Zika has continued to spread. 44 states so far have reported pregnant women with evidence of Zika infections, and that ranges from as far north as Washington State, where we met Maria, to states like Florida and Texas, where there have been many more cases, and the virus last year was spread by local mosquitoes. Most primary care docs haven't really seen anything like this before. I learned that CDC experts are worried because only about one in every four babies who have been born to these Zika-infected moms have been getting the brain imaging that they need to really tell the extent of the damage.
And what do we know in terms of
outcomes. The doctor in your story was an expert on microcephaly, but with Zika, there are unknowns and other complicating factors, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a really hard question. Doctors tell me it really varies depending on the child and the damage that's immediately apparent, and in some cases, the time during pregnancy in which the mom was infected. Some babies have obvious problems, including these very small heads, neurological damage, contorted limbs in some cases, and trouble with vision and hearing. Others are less severe. Because they haven't seen it very often before, doctors have a difficult time advising parents exactly what the future will hold. In Maria's case, they say that Ariana could develop seizures in the future and that she'll almost certainly have trouble with her vision.
Janelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonelle Alicia is a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She's been working with her colleague, multimedia reporter Heidi DeMarco, to bring us the story about Zika-related birth defects. A lot of us have been complaining about the high price of prescription drugs for years and years, but just how mad people were became visible when Martin Shkreli, the young pharma exec, jacked up the price of an HIV drug, and the internet exploded in outrage. But there are lots of other examples. There was public outcry over the steep price increase of EpiPens. It just seems like generally there is a lot of pent-up frustration. But how do you channel all that energy into something that actually brings about change? Dan Gorenstein introduces us to one man who is trying to do just that.
Okay, here we go.
67-year-old David Mitchell loves to sing. He thought he'd spend his retirement with the National Philharmonic Chorale.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow.
Or head back to school, become a professor. At David's retirement party 7 months ago, Ben, one of his four kids, agreed his dad gives a good lecture.
Dad, when I know I'm about to get an opinion from you, I clear my calendar for the afternoon.
Ultimately, though, David decided to use his voice like this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me here today.
In March, David testified in front of Congress, a hearing on drug prices.
I'm founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs. We're a national organization focused exclusively on policies to lower prescription drug prices. To maintain our independence, we don't accept funding from any organizations that profit from the development and distribution of prescription drugs.
What David didn't say is that most major patient organizations do. In fact, drug and medical device companies are cutting checks to more than 80% of the largest advocacy groups in the country and have largely avoided the issue of drug prices.
There's been a real conspicuous silence, actually, around patient advocacy organizations on the issue of drug pricing.
That's Matthew McCoy, a University of Pennsylvania researcher who studied patient groups.
People have rightly raised questions. Well, they can't really speak out because if they do that, that might jeopardize funding that they depend on from actors in the drug and device industry.
No one can say whether this money nudges patients and their advocates into silence, effectively lining up with industry. What we do know is industry relies on patient stories to promote their own interests.
There are patients out there that don't have a lot of time.
Just like in this ad produced by the pharmaceutical industry trade group, Pharma.
My life was saved by a two-week-old targeted therapy drug.
That's what really drives me to save lives.
Of course, drug makers produce products that improve, extend, even save people's lives. Yet this tactic has also helped drug makers persuade Congress to adopt a maze of protections, giving them power to jack up prices. David Mitchell says the way they've monopolized the patient's voice means it's near impossible to hear the other story, the one about how those high prices are hitting tons of Americans, and he's determined to change that.
Patients all over this country and consumers are struggling. They're losing their homes. They're dipping into their kids' college funds. They are sometimes not taking their drugs or they're cutting their pills in half.
What too few people realize, says David, is that one in five Americans report not filling a prescription because it's too expensive. Seniors on Medicare, often with fixed incomes, face out-of-pocket costs as high as $12,000 to treat conditions like MS and cancer. David aims to get data points like these in front of Congress and state lawmakers, but to do it in the form of human stories, including his own.
More importantly for the committee, I'm a relapsed cancer patient with multiple myeloma. It's an incurable blood disease. Drugs are keeping me alive.
Yes, this is how David Mitchell gets your attention. He's actually got $40,000 worth of drugs running through his body every month.
If you saw the x-rays, I looked at them once and I will never look at them again because I have holes in my skull and in my arm bones and in my pelvis.
Sometimes David catches himself, rubbing his arms, checking to see if his bones are still solid. But that day in Washington, David told the committee he's lucky. Between Medicare and savings, he and his wife Nicole can handle whatever costs come their way. Many can't. It all struck a chord with Maryland Democrat Representative Elijah Cummings.
Mr. Mitchell, I'm going to make sure that President Trump hears your testimony because there are a lot of people that are going through what you're going through. And I thank God that you take your pain, turn it into a passion to do your purpose.
That's the power of being a patient and how to move an issue. And I don't know how good I am at the end of the day, but it's what I know how to do.
David might not know how good he is, but Chuck Hurley, one of David's board members, has an opinion on that. And he says, trust him. David is very, very good.
He knows how to combine the voices of families that have been hurt into a powerful national movement.
Before he was a cancer patient advocating for lower drug prices, David spent his whole career as a communications executive in Washington, orchestrating major public health campaigns like passing tougher seatbelt laws and curbing youth smoking. Chuck first met David when he hired David to work on one of those campaigns back in the 80s. Chuck says Patients for Affordable Drugs is doing what David typically does, share the stories of real people being hurt. As former head of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Chuck saw that strategy pay off. He remembers lobbying a powerful congressman back in the mid-80s on a bill to adopt a national drinking age.
His first and really only question to me was, Chuck, how do the mothers feel? We literally got the national drinking age through the House on a voice vote.
That's where Patients for Affordable Drugs hopes to be someday. Just 12 weeks in, the campaign is shaping up. The group has already gathered up nearly 7,000 stories. They've begun to advocate for legislation. They plan to line up people to talk at healthcare conferences. They want people to testify.
There has not been an organized effort to put a human face on the drug pricing problem. And so in that way, what we're doing is a lot like MAD that said the issue's happening, but it's invisible.
While David's dreaming big, this work is more than starting a movement. Of course he wants to see drugs become more affordable. For him, though, his involvement stems from a deeper place, his need to be part of something bigger than himself, his need to look away from himself.
I think it's this way for all cancer patients. You have to be optimistic. The idea that death is visible out there somewhere, it's crippling if I do that. So I don't.
It's taken time for David to get comfortable with this voice, his patient voice, and all that it implies. But he says he's liking the sound of it.
Well, oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I've got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
This story was reported by Dan Gorenstein. He covers the business of healthcare for Marketplace. Finding a new path is one thing, but getting people to actually use that path can be a completely different challenge. A couple of years ago, something called PrEP became available in the fight against the spread of HIV. That stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's a combination of anti-HIV medications that can be really effective to prevent new infections. But getting this new weapon accepted by people who need it has been a bit of an uphill battle. Let's listen back to this story about health, love, and sex reported by Alana Gordon in 2015 when PrEP was still brand new.
John Vaz is 34. He's fit and smart. A real catch. And a little over a year ago, he found himself in a somewhat unusual situation. For him, he was single. it didn't last long.
We actually met on Grindr.
It's a popular hookup app.
It was fairly innocuous.
Uh-huh.
I was sitting at home watching a French movie with a friend.
Vaz lives in D.C.
And he was somewhere else in D.C. watching a movie on a Shabbat dinner night with his friends.
They talked movies for a bit.
We exchanged phone numbers.
And then they met for coffee the next day.
And so you just started like immediately like sparks or like?
I think at the time really enjoyed spending time with each other, and a coffee date became a sort of hangout date, and then let's get dinner and then let's go back to yours and, you know.
A few months later, they moved in together. It was fantastic. It was comfortable. Something was missing.
Suffice to say, life is too short for bad sex.
Vaz and his partner decided to open up their relationship. They were still committed to each other, but agreed it was okay to have other sexual partners. Vaz was totally on board, but he did worry about one thing, HIV. He uses condoms, but with their new relationship status, what if? What if?
The barrier methods of protection might fail on my own volition or unintentionally.
This brought Vaz face to face with a new option, a new preventive tool that hadn't really been around before. It's called PrEP.
PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
PrEP is a combination HIV drug, brand name Truvada. Studies have shown that if it's taken consistently once a day, it can reduce the risk of HIV up to 90% compared with those who don't take it. Vaz was in a quandary. Should he take PrEP? I should note there is some irony here, because Vaz is an infectious disease doctor.
You know, we are also human even if we are physicians.
He's the HIV director at one of the biggest health centers in Baltimore, and he has several dozen patients on PrEP. Dr. Vaz says HIV is a powerful virus, but it needs to take control of cells to proliferate.
They cannot do anything by themselves. They need to get into a cell and hijack a cell's machinery to survive.
But the drug Truvada, if it's already in a person's body at the right levels, basically stops the HIV virus from taking over that cell. And so the virus dies. Some advocates liken PrEP to birth control for HIV. They see it as a major, I mean major, prevention tool.
Some of the modeling that the WHO did showed that in the next 10 years, if PrEP was rolled out to men who have sex with men, it could avert 1 million infections. That's a huge number.
Reported side effects can include some nausea at first. Vaz says the main thing is monitoring a person's kidneys, because that's how the drug's secreted. For many, PrEP's still a really new concept. But for Vaz, in his own practice, the real success of PrEP is not about writing a prescription.
But it also allows for us then to have this forum of someone's life, which, you know, health is about so much more than just giving someone pills.
He's seen it open up conversations about stigma, about HIV, whatever one's status, about sexuality, about fear, about intimacy.
It really just helps people to start thinking about their sexual health and make good decisions in their quieter moments of their lives that hopefully will pervade those heat of the moment, lustful, passionate moments.
That was infectious disease doctor John Vaz speaking with reporter Alana Gordon 2 years ago. Since then, that Baltimore clinic where he used to work has expanded its PrEP program. John, meanwhile, has gotten married, and he now works at a health clinic in Maui.
So where are we in terms of PrEP acceptance? When taken correctly, it's 99% effective at preventing HIV infections. It's expensive, yes, but it's covered by major insurance companies and by Medicaid. If you're in a high-risk group, for example, in a relationship with an HIV-positive partner or an injection drug user, then PrEP is recommended. But
like many innovations, it took a while for people to know what it was, to know that this drug was out there, and to actually trust the information that they were hearing about PrEP.
That's Greg Millett, the director of public policy at MFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, and he's been monitoring the progress of PrEP since it was developed a decade ago. And Greg says the pill has been steadily gaining acceptance among men who are at risk.
66% of new infections in our country each year are among gay and bisexual men. So it's really terrific and hopeful that the populations that need it most are taking PrEP. There are some drawbacks as well, though. So even though gay and bisexual men are more likely to be infected by HIV in the United States and recognize that risk and are taking PrEP, we're finding that not all populations of gay and bisexual men are benefiting from PrEP.
I was just going to ask you about that. How so?
Well, we know that among gay men, Black gay and bisexual men are most at risk for HIV. So when you take a look at the HIV data, white gay men have a 1 in 6 likelihood of a lifetime risk of having HIV. Black gay men, 1 in 3 currently, are already HIV positive. So this is a population where we really need to make sure that PrEP is available. But you find in study after study that Black gay men are less likely to access PrEP as compared to white gay men.
Any idea why? What are the reasons?
Sure. Some of the reasons, or one of the biggest reasons, is access to health insurance. We know that, you know, overall, African Americans are less likely to have access to health insurance compared with whites. If you don't have health insurance, you're less likely to go in and get tested for HIV. You're also less likely to be covered for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
When PrEP first became available, there was a lot of talk among gay men about, what does it say about me if I'm taking PrEP? And there was sort of these discussions around shaming and, you need PrEP because you do X, Y, and Z. So has that gone away? Has there been a better acceptance sort of the drug?
I think that we've reached a turning point right now where a lot of that has abated. In the early days of PrEP, individuals were almost ashamed to say that they were taking this medication. That's really changed quite a bit in the last few years because there are many more individuals who are taking it, and there are more individuals who are really talking about how effective it's been for making sure that it minimizes anxiety for HIV transmission within their lives.
So it's not anymore, I'm such an irresponsible individual, I need to take PrEP. The narrative is more, I'm a responsible individual, therefore I take PrEP.
Exactly. We definitely have turned the corner on the stigma that's been associated with taking PrEP, where there are far more people who believe that it's responsible for you to be doing so within the gay community.
What's the future of PrEP, of the work that's been done so far in a changed political climate? I mean, the future of the ACA is unsure, and there are just a lot of unknowns right now.
There are indeed quite a few unknowns. And you know, I think some of the things that most of us are worried about, at least in the scientific community, is, you know, what we're looking at in terms of the proposed budget from the White House. But there are also bright spots that are on the horizon. And I think one of the biggest bright spots are some of the new research that's being done out there. We do know that there's some individuals who are less likely to take a pill a day, every day. And there's research now that's looking at long-acting PrEP. So they're looking at injectable PrEP. If you're able to actually inject PrEP and keep them protected from anywhere from 2 months to 3 months, would that increase the number of individuals who would be taking it? And would it also reduce markedly the number of infections in marginalized communities such as Black gay men or particularly young Black gay men? So this is all incredibly exciting. We have a whole new frontier that's out there and a lot of promise in terms of making sure that not only PrEP is available to all, but that PrEP is also administered in a way that could reduce HIV infection for even more people than it does now.
Greg Millett is the Director of Public Policy at MFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research.
Our show is about people versus problems today, and sometimes it just takes one person to make a difference. When a California man heard about terminally ill children who had no families and were dying alone in hospitals, he decided he could take care of them and he could be their dad. Reporter Erica Lenz brings us his story.
I didn't really tell many people about this story, you know? I mean, for a long time I didn't talk about it.
Mohamed Bazik, a 62-year-old retired engineer, will always remember how the story started, when he met a boy with long lashes.
He has long lashes, dark lashes, and even the nurses envy him.
The boy with long lashes couldn't hear, he couldn't see, he couldn't move his body or regulate his temperature. The baby boy was born with birth defects and a skull full of fluid, and, as far as Mohamed knows, was left by his mother when she crossed the border back to Mexico. Mohamed met the foster boy while he was still in the hospital.
Well, the minute I saw him, I fell in love with this kid. Unbelievable. I mean, it's like I know him for a long time.
As he'd done with so many other children, Mohamed took the boy, whom we can't name because he was in foster care, home with him. He's the only person in Los Angeles County who exclusively takes in children with terminal illnesses. Before he was a foster dad, Mohamed lived in Libya, and he came to the U.S. to study engineering. He met his wife here, and they quickly learned of the dire need for people to take in children who are dying. Kids whose parents just can't handle it. Somehow, Mohamed handles it, again and again. Caring for children with complex medical needs is hard, but losing them is harder.
10 children die in my house, and most of them, I was holding them in my arms, you know?
Mohamed and his wife had fostered dozens of children when, in 1997, they had their own biological son. Here they'd been sharing their home with kids who needed constant supervision and care. And then their son Adam was born with dwarfism and brittle bone disease.
When he born, he has 8 skull fraction, broken jaws, broken legs and arms.
Adam is 19 now and weighs 65 pounds. He can't stand, but he gets around on a device Mohamed made from an ironing board and roller skate wheels. At school, it was dangerous for Adam to play with other kids, but there was one person Adam did get close to, his blind and deaf foster brother. They were an unlikely pair. One was unusually small and couldn't be touched. The other was unusually tall, and touch was his only way to communicate.
Because Adam's so small, Adam, he used to crawl over him, lay down on his chest and give him a hug.
Every night, when it was time for his foster brother's medicine, Adam would turn on music, and Mohamed would pick up his foster son and dance with him. But as with his other children, the happy times couldn't last. The boy was 6 when doctors told Mohamed he didn't have long to live, and it would be fine to leave him at the hospital.
I said, no, I never let him in the hospital. I've been taking care of him since he was a baby, and this is time he needs me more than before.
2 months later, his foster child died.
We visit him, you know. I visit my kids, still visiting my kids in the cemetery. I go, me and Adam, and there are 8 of them in the same cemetery.
In the years since that loss, Mohamed has also lost his wife. And now he cares for Adam and foster children by himself, leaving the house only when a nurse can cover for him. It's grueling work that seems almost crazy. But for Mohamed, it's the most important thing he can do to give his life meaning.
There's a lot of people that say, why are you taking kids dying? Why? I said, if you don't take them, nobody want to take them. The world have forgotten about them. And as a human being, I need to help somebody who needs my help.
And he'll keep helping them, one by one, for as long as he can.
That was Erica Lance reporting. She originally produced this story for Kind World. That's a podcast from the Boston Public Radio station WBUR, and it explores the profound effect one act can have on our lives.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. Cancer pushes us. We push back. Cancer Treatment Centers of America is challenging conventional thinking and is working to find smarter solutions. With 5 treatment centers located throughout the United States, CTCA is forging ahead with technology that wasn't available to cancer patients just a short time ago. More at cancercenter.com/outsmart.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. On today's show, people versus problems. Just as you solve one problem, another one arises. That happens all the time. Here's an example. Let's say you're a smoker and you are HIV positive. In the early days of the HIV epidemic, smoking was probably the least of your worries. But scientists and doctors have figured out ways to keep people alive and healthy. And now that HIV is no longer a death sentence, smoking is a problem, and kicking the habit becomes more urgent. Morgan Springer from Michigan's Interlochen Public Radio met a woman with HIV who's hoping to quit.
April Anderson was a kid when she had her first cigarette.
I've been smoking ever since I could sneak cigarettes from my mom and dad. So I've been smoking since I've been 10, but been smoking in front of my parents since I've been 12. And I'm 53 years old.
She used to think it was cool.
Marlboros were it. You know, Raleighs, cool, Salems.
Now she says it's not.
People look at you and they just kind of like, ew.
When did it become not cool?
A couple of years ago to me.
April's ready to be done with cigarettes. She's already tried to stop a few times. Once she quit cold turkey without any help, that lasted 2 days. Smoking just has a hold on her.
Can you describe what addiction feels like to you?
It's like having to go pee so bad that you can't hold it. And you're doing that pee-pee dance.
She says you make that feeling go away by having a cigarette. And that's exactly what April did last year. After being smoke-free, holding it in for around 8 months.
Here's that. You can have that.
Okay, I can have this.
April is dropping off paperwork at an HIV and AIDS center in Traverse City, Michigan. It's called the Thomas Judd Care Center. They've helped April quit in the past.
Hey, Tori. Hey.
Care coordinator Victoria Camerata offers patients help to stop smoking. But she says some people don't want help.
And those that don't want to quit really don't want to quit. Like, they're like, it's my last vice. And are very firm with it. Like, I will not quit smoking. Let's not talk about it again.
Smoking can feel like a necessary comfort after you've given up drugs or stopped drinking. And on top of that, had to make all sorts of adjustments to living with HIV. Longtime smoker April Anderson has had to make all those life changes over the years. Roughly 15% of American adults smoke, but the rate is much higher for people with HIV. Victoria says that's because people with HIV often fall into 3 groups that have higher smoking rates than the general population. People who identify as LGBTQ, substance abusers, or people who deal with mental health problems. HIV is no longer a death sentence, but Victoria says the disease is hard on the body.
Basically, it intensifies the disease process. So anything that would happen to a normal person with aging happens quicker with HIV. And then when you smoke on top of that, it happens even more rapidly.
Smokers who have HIV are at even greater risk of having a stroke, cancer, and lung and heart disease. Victoria takes out what's called a quit kit, a plastic water bottle full of things to help smokers ignore cravings.
And then inside of it, we stuffed them with chamomile tea,
yes.
Flavored water,
the toothpick,
this lip balm.
Nice.
It's really...
Quit kits are not new, but in recent years, HIV treatment centers in Michigan are paying more attention to smoking habits and are making quitting a bigger priority. It's really common for people to try 5, 6, 10 times to quit, but counseling and nicotine replacement products, like patches, can improve your chance of success. April's tried those things, but stressors like a car accident got in the way, and she's back to smoking. April grabs a pack of Basic Reds from her car. She's gone from smoking 40 cigarettes a day to 8.
See, I just got a few cigarettes in here now.
April has a number of quitting tricks. Only brings some cigarettes in the pack with her to work.
Instead of smoking a whole cigarette, I smoke a half of one.
Or she tries to wait an extra half hour before having her next cigarette, which is hard if she has nothing to distract her.
I just sit there and focus on it. Oh, I smoke a cigarette. Oh, I smoke a cigarette. Oh, I want a cigarette. You know, and it just drives me nuts, and I end up smoking one.
A pack costs April $7.60.
Come on. I can save that money and take a trip to Florida and see my granddaughter.
April lights up her cigarette outside. It's a beautiful sunny day, not too hot.
See, this is why I like smoking. This is what I associate with smoking. It's the birds, and you can hear the trees and stuff.
How do you feel right now as you're having a cigarette?
Relaxed. Just kind of chilled. Say, okay, cool.
She stands there facing the woods and smoking. April has lots of things motivating her. Her friends, her family, particularly her granddaughter. And last year, she set a big goal.
I guess I just have to keep trying. Because I will be quit by Christmas for sure.
It didn't happen, but she's still trying. Maybe this Christmas. For The Pulse, I'm Morgan Springer.
We've been talking about problems today, big and small, how they manifest in our world and in our lives. Here's the story of a young mother who found out she had breast cancer while she was pregnant. And she said even though that was, of course, a big shock, she was okay when she stayed focused on navigating her illness and her treatment. But then finding her path after chemo has been a little bit more difficult.
My name is Jenny Lai. I'm 34 years old, and I live in Baltimore, Maryland. You know, the last 11 months was a blur of doctor's visits and chemo and surgery and radiation, and now I'm all done. So now I'm trying to adjust to life after cancer, which sounds kind of weird, but it's exciting. Whenever anyone hears cancer, they automatically think chemotherapy. The first day was terrifying. I walked in and I was the youngest person in the room by at least 20 years. On top of that, I was pregnant. So we had a lot of very sad looks, and I hated that. It was hard enough to go through, but to like feel people looking at me and feeling pity for me was just upsetting at the same time. But I will say that once I got started, it felt good to have a plan and start, you know, really attacking this thing. Over the course of 6 months, I went through 16 rounds of chemo, and then I had a bilateral mastectomy in early January, and then I did radiation daily for 5 weeks. You become so focused on the plan and everything that you're doing to kill the cancer that it's like you almost don't think about it too much, or at least I didn't. And even now I have these moments of like, oh my God, I can't believe that like I had cancer. And I can say that in the past tense now. And it's pretty trippy.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what.
So our daughter's name is Chloe, and she is just the sweetest little baby.
Like a diamond in the.
It's funny because, like, in a way, I feel like cancer has made me sort of a better mother. It's made me more patient. It's given me the opportunity to sort of slow down and be a little bit more present in my life. I don't feel that I was that way before. You know, I worked, I was busy, I was really focused on a lot of things, and I stressed out over things that don't matter, you know, in the grand scheme of things. But now I find myself a little bit more able to stop and say, does this thing matter? Does that, you know, is this really worth stressing out over?
I love you, Chloe.
triple negative breast cancer has a very high rate of recurrence as well. So that sort of anxiety is something that I am currently dealing with. It's something I put in the back of my mind while I was going through treatment, but now it's very much there. You know, the whole time it's like, I'm just going to get through this. I'm going to check off the boxes. I'm going to do all the things I'm supposed to. And you're so focused on that. And then when it's over, it's like, what do I do now? So this end part is very exciting, but it can be a little anxiety producing as well, because, you know, for the rest of my life, cancer is on my, you know, health record. And the thought of recurrence and fear of recurrence is always going to be there. So right now I'm sort of in a transition of adapting to that and accepting that.
That was Jenny Live from Maryland, and she told us her story for our series, Patient Files. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, Alan Yu, and Elizabeth Fiedler. She brought us the story we just heard of the new mom who gave birth and then immediately had to get back to fighting cancer.
They wheeled me downstairs and I did CT scans, I did MRIs, I did bone scans, and the whole time, like, it's really cheesy, but like the whole time I just kept envisioning my daughter's face, and that helped me kind of get through those like scary moments.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Liz Tung is our intern. We had help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Tanya English, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.